Hello, I'm Andrew Scrivani.
And I'm Chef John. Welcome to the Chef John podcast.
Hey, Chef John, how's it going?
Good. How are you doing, Andrew?
I'm doing great. Today's Veterans Day, John. I wanted to give a shout out to our veterans and say a huge thank you to all of our veterans, including my father, who is a Navy man. Thank you all for your service. Today is your day, and hopefully the podcast makes you happy. So thank you to all our veterans.
Yes, let me second all those sentiments. And did I just say sentiments?
Yes, a lot of sentiments.
That's what you get at the bottom of a chicken stock once it's settled. I think I mean sentiments. But yes, absolutely. Thank you so much for your service. You know, anytime any of us complain about anything remotely difficult, let's try to remember that there's actually people that do like impossible things, things that only a tiny percentage of humans are able to do. And these are the people we're thanking today.
Absolutely. As we begin every show, we want to take a moment to do a little bit of housekeeping. We really encourage you to interact with us on Twitter and Instagram at Chef John Pod. We love your feedback. We have such a good time there. We love when you respond to our polls and when you kind of get threads going and talk and have discussions and arguments among yourselves. Please continue that because we are really, really enjoying that. And we can't express how much we love your comments and suggestions, so please keep them coming. And at any point, just go ahead and pause this episode and then go and leave us a review on your podcast platform of choice, along with what, John?
A 5-star rating, preferably. And I'm totally fine if you actually want to wait till the end of the show and then go, oh, yeah, that was totally 5-star material, and then leave the comment in the 5-star. But as Andrew said, at any time, you're like, I can't wait. Pause it. Give us the 5-star rating. Leave a few words of wisdom or compliments, suggestions, and so forth. And we would very much appreciate it.
Hair care, beard care.
All the above.
Yeah, any of it. You know, dressing advice, whatever you like. Just throw it all in there and we eat that stuff up. Pun intended. And finally, you can leave us a message on our website, thechefjohnpodcast.com, or leave us a voicemail. John really, really likes those.
Love the voicemail.
He loves the voicemail. And we can feature it on a future show. That's all our housekeeping for today, John. What do you think about all that?
I love it. I almost paused the recording and went on to give us a rating. So pretty good work there. You got me.
And that brings us to our first segment of the show this week. It is John's favorite, his absolute favorite. Run it up the pole.
What is that? The slide whistle?
Slide whistle, yeah.
I've watched a couple cartoons in my day. All kidding aside, I do usually almost always several times in the past enjoyed our Run It Up the Pole segment. But today, I really think we have a winner. I'm really looking forward to this.
This was quite the poll. We had an overwhelming response on Twitter, so thank you. We had the most responses and interactions that we've ever had on our social media. So this poll clearly struck a nerve, and we're going to spend some time talking about it. So, John, you want to do the honors and read out those poll results?
Yeah, the poll was, is foodie an appropriate term to call a food lover or someone who's just a food fanatic? I know a lot of people get upset at this term. It's very polarizing. It's kind of like a love it or hate it type thing. And when we posed this, I was assuming that I was going to be in the minority, that most people were going to say, no, absolutely not. It's a horrible term. It's insulting. But you know what? Our poll has said otherwise. On Twitter, the yes, 69% to 31% no. And on Instagram, almost identical, 68% to 32% yes to no. So the public has spoken. Our friends out there have no problem, most of them at least, no problem with someone using the word foodie.
It's interesting, right? It's like the embracing of the pejorative, because I always took foodie as sort of almost like derogatory. I never really saw it as a positive. And I guess people have just embraced the word.
Like calling an actual redneck a redneck. Or is that different?
That might be a little different. You know, the origin of that though, right?
Oh, yes. Having spent, you know, a good portion of my early childhood as a literal redneck, picking corn and working outside and mowing lawns for a living and schlepping bottles to the recycling place for 5 cents, a Coke bottle. I quite often had a very red sunburned neck. No one cared about skin cancer back then. They're like, you'll be fine. And by the way, if this is your first Chef John podcast, we give no medical advice, especially even with the food stuff. Really, maybe don't take it too seriously. But you know, when it comes to medical stuff, ignore everything we say, or at least that's what our future legal department would like us mention right now.
And if you really, really need to go to WebMD and they'll tell you everything you need to know. You could spend a lot of time there.
But anyway, back to the poll. It's funny. I've never considered foodie any kind of an insult or a negative statement, or what was the word you used, pejorative. I think the people that don't like it and don't think you should use it are trying to almost spin it that way. To me, it's just a simple way to save a few words describing your friend that's just a nut about food. Mary's a foodie. She would have loved that new Thai restaurant. She's such a foodie. To me, that's how I use it. That's how I don't mind people using it. What I find, I don't know if ironic's the right word, but people that almost think it's a term for someone that's almost self-congratulatory, self-grandizing their love of food.
Well, we have another word for that, John.
Yeah, I actually think the people that don't like the word foodie are the real foodies, because that's sort of what they're doing. They're trying to spin it that way, where the rest of us are just innocently using it as just another word. And I know I'll make an analogy only because you hate this word. But, you know, like when I call someone a Trekkie, not that I ever would, it's never come up.
Right. Yeah.
It's never, I run in these circles, but I'm certainly not insulting that person. I'm just indicating that my friend, in context of this story I'm telling, really is into Star Trek.
Let's unpack this a little bit. The whole Trekkie, Trekker thing, right? That's a good model for this, because the Trekkie thing is almost diminishing, like almost childlike or infantile, where you put the ER at the end, seems like it has a little bit more importance. But unfortunately, when you do that with foodie, it becomes fooder.
No.
That one just doesn't work for me at all.
Let's get this right out of the way. Whether you like foodie or not, it's too late to go with anything else. Foodist is not going to come into vogue. Fooder, we've just discussed, not happening. Gourmand had its 7 days in 1972. Human, I guess that's a little general. But anyway, I think foodie has been used so ubiquitously now that we're stuck with it, like it or not. So to find some kind of problem with it or negative connotation, I think it's just people, which seems to be prevalent these days, almost running out of things to be incensed about.
Well, you know, the comments section on the Twitter feed was pretty interesting when it came to that delineation, right? Because I think there were a lot of people who were interested in that word gourmand that you brought up. And I think that becomes a little hierarchical, right? Is that the people who identify as gourmands look down on the foodies.
Yeah, you cannot be a gourmand unless you actually have a private chef in your mansion. Who could, you know, let's be clear and be fair, you know, be part-time butler, part-time driver, part-time personal chef.
Okay, so it could be multifaceted.
Well, yes, gourmand, I definitely think is a little classist. Is that a word?
Yeah, I think that's right.
A little highfalutin. Foodie can be anybody from any background, anywhere, that just really is into food. And it's one nice, neat word that a lot of things rhyme with that you can call them that. It's easy. It's fast. Two syllable words. Some of my favorite words are two syllables. So I just think it works on almost every level. Plus, I'm not going to lie, I actually enjoy that it upsets the actual foodies, who are the negative connotation of the thing they are. Was that projection?
Yes.
That makes me enjoy it even more, that a very small percentage. And of course, I have to include my wife, Michelle, in this, who is not a fan of the word foodie. She's in that 30%. We got to give these folks their voice too. For a third of the audience, they're not feeling it.
So do you think that Michelle's characterization of that word is an indication that she thinks there should be some qualifications to the words?
No, I don't think so. I think she's just annoyed by the word, like people are annoyed when someone calls San Francisco Frisco.
Oh.
If someone doesn't like it, they really don't like it. And they just think it's not a good thing to do. That's the other thing. I don't know if we even have to bother with coming up with other terms.
We could dive a little bit deeper here, John, because the Webster's Dictionary defines a foodie as a person having an avid interest in the latest food fads. Now, that's a little different, right?
Yes, I would totally disagree with that ending. It should be. And I don't know if we have any people deep inside Merriam-Webster, probably. But I would think if we could maybe arrange, blackmail, whatever we have to do, to have that change to a person having an avid interest in food. Done. To me, the avid interest is the key point. Of course, if you have an avid interest in food, you're going to be like, oh, what's the latest food fad? Oh, that looks interesting. Have you seen that on Instagram? So that just goes with the territory. Because if you have an avid interest in food, but not the latest food trends? Like, that would be weird.
I find that last bit of that definition opens up a whole different realm of conversation around fads and food rather than just being into food like a gourmand.
Right. To me, that's where we're separating, like, oh, these people aren't real food lovers. They're just interested in the pop music of food.
Oh, okay. There
we go. Versus someone that's at home listening to opera and symphonies and knows like their songs that have more than four chords. Foodie is like almost considered like you're into bubblegum pop band, boy band type thing.
Yeah, top 40 foods.
Yeah, top 40 foods, and you're not a true food lover. Like, you don't know the history and you don't have the pedigree to call yourself a real gourmand. I got to stop saying that.
And we say it fancy too when we say it.
By the way, my middle name is Armand.
Wow.
I'm going to have to do some research on the root of that mand. Am I related to gourmands? I don't know. Could be.
I mean, it could just be genetic.
But anyway, getting back to what we were talking about. Oh, foodie. I don't think we need to replace it with any better, more accurate words because there aren't any. We have to go back to the original. Before the word foodie was around, people just used a sentence to describe someone's avid love of food and or food fads.
Foodie's been around since the 80s, and it's going to be around a lot longer.
Who invented this term?
It came up in a restaurant review by New York writer Gail Green, but it was Ann Barr and Paul Levy of England's Harper's and Queen who popularized it. So it appeared in a New York article of Food Review and then started to become more of the parlance by Ann Barr and Paul Levy. This is the research that we do here at the Chef John Podcast, our research department, which sits right next to the legal department and the advertising and the marketing department. They all sit together.
Well, if you don't mind me foreshadowing a little bit, since it was popularized by a couple Brits, I like it even more now. So I want to say, I don't want to spoil my pairing later.
Let's leave that. Okay.
So our final conclusion, foodie is, according to our audience, completely fine to use. And why I really love these results and I'm happy with them, I do have one little part of me that's disappointed in the results.
So it's about 30% of you?
31% of me.
Okay, right.
Is not happy right now. And the reason is, as you know, we were originally going to go into my outrageous food take,
right,
which was going to be, unlike 96% of our audience, I'm fine with the word foodie. And I was going to defend it. This was going to be the hill of beans I, you know, die on. And boom, there's the poll. And everyone agrees with me. And we can't have a segment, Chef John's outrageous conventional wisdom take of the day. So we are going to completely skip outrageous food take because it's not going to work. My outrageous food take is very not outrageous and completely in line with how most people think, unless only foodies and self-identified foodies fill out polls about food online, which actually could be a thing.
It's possible.
Thank God these aren't scientifically done.
Not at all.
Isn't there like always fine print at the bottom of a poll that says, like, you read through it and you look at all the data and you agonize. And then at the bottom, it says, this might be total BS. Don't believe any of this for any reason. It could be completely wrong. Disclaimer. We should add one of those to our polls. But anyway, the public has spoken, or at least almost 2/3 of them.
I'm so excited, John. You know why?
Because we're doing pairings.
Every time I get loaded up, you just pull the rug out from under me. I feel like Charlie Brown every time Lucy pulled a football out from under his foot.
In the business, we call that a shtick.
Yeah, well.
You can start over and I'll pretend not to know what we're doing.
Okay, good. Thanks. John, I'm so excited.
Why?
Because we're at our most favorite segment on the show, pairings.
Oh, I did not see that coming. No, I also am excited. I love both these shows, and I hope you're going to go first.
I will go first. This is an odd recommendation for me, I have to say, right off the bat. And I'll tell you why. I'm recommending HBO's House of the Dragon. And the reason it's odd for me was that I was not an avid Game of Thrones fan. I got dragged into Game of Thrones kicking and screaming because my wife wanted to watch it. She liked it. She binged it. We were watching it. It felt like endlessly for 3 or 4 months, where every time I walked in the room, it was on. So I ended up watching it. I wouldn't say begrudgingly, but it wasn't something I looked forward to, like Sunday night watching, like a lot of these great HBO shows are. So I said, you know what? I want to watch a new show. And this was getting a lot of hype. And I was like, all right, let me give it a shot. And sure enough, I really like it. I think it's a really interesting, fun show. And I did not have that reaction when I first encountered Game of Thrones when it first came on. It wasn't something that struck me as something I was really interested in. But this, for some reason, caught my interest, caught my attention. And if you're not familiar with Game of Thrones, this is focusing on a period of time, 170 years before the events of Game of Thrones. And it's focusing on one particular family line. And it happens to be the family line that can control the dragons, which were the most powerful family 170 years ago. And I'm not going to give you any spoilers, but the reality is, if you're into fantasy, if you're a Game of Thrones fan, I'm sure you're already watching it. But if you weren't a Game of Thrones fan, I think this is who I'm speaking to now. Give it a shot. It's got a lot of intrigue and it's very interesting. It's beautiful to look at. The CGI parts are not as prevalent as you might think with a show called The House of the Dragon, because the dragons only show up maybe once a show. And it's really more of human drama. And it's very interesting and fun. And I'm not going to get into a whole lot of specifics because I don't want to ruin anything for you. What I want to say is, if you like that type of show, it's for you. If you've never liked that type of show, it might be for you, because that's the perspective I came from. So go check it out. Give it a shot. The first couple of episodes, it picks up pretty quick. You get the gist of what's happening and go for it. Just get in there and go to the House of the Dragon and really enjoy yourself. And the thing I keep thinking about, and I'm sure this happened when people watch Game of Thrones as well, or any of these shows that are set in this kind of medieval periods, is I keep thinking about like barbecue turkey legs, like you get at medieval times.
Renaissance fair.
So I did a little bit of research when I was thinking about this, and every article I pulled up had the same exact reaction. I guess it's just a natural cultural reaction to this period in time to think about just holding a giant drumstick and like chowing down. And of course, we are in November, John. So there will be some turkey leg opportunities here.
Oh, yeah.
So I think that if you're going to watch The House of the Dragon, get yourself some turkey legs, sit in front of the TV, maybe wear a breastplate, a crown, I don't know, dress your dog up like a dragon and just go for it like whole hog. Just dive right in and enjoy it.
If possible, sit on a chair made of knives.
Yes, if you can make a chair of knives, you can do that.
That's always super comfortable.
Very plush.
Well, I love your pairing, both parts of it. I'm a big Game of Thrones fan, although I'm not super fantasy show, as we've discussed, guy. But the original Game of Thrones, I believe I saw the first episode traveling on some kind of food blogger jaunt, or I always hesitate to say food writer. I never like consider myself a food writer until at least three drinks into the cocktail party. Then I was right up there with the best of them. But I remember being in some hotel room somewhere and they had no idea what this thing was. They got HBO here at least and watching, going, wow, this is different. And then came home and watched all the rest religiously. What's surprising about my love for this House of Dragon new series is I'm generally not a big prequel guy. I'm always like, why didn't we just do these in order? Why are we going back? You should have done this one first. And then everyone would have understood things, because in the actual Game of Thrones, again, without giving things away, part of the challenge of that show is who the blank are they talking about? And why is that such a big deal? And then six episodes later, you're like, oh, they killed their sister. Got it. By the way, no one kills their sister. That was just off the top of my head. So I'm not a big prequel guy. Like the Star Wars prequels kill me. I have no idea what anyone's talking about or what's going on. I just blank out after 40 seconds. All superhero prequels, no thanks. I don't want to see so-and-so as a kid. Like, you know, the Amazing Hulk Jr. Show me Hulk when he's green and enraged. But in this case, it really kind of works because it's kind of fun filling in the blanks that you were maybe still curious about from the main, what do us insiders call it? G-O-T. Which is the foodie of this HBO series.
Are you a throner? You call it a throner, a throny?
You're not a throny. But anyway, no, I really enjoy the show. It's different enough from Game of Thrones to not just seem like extra footage that they found. And it's kind of interesting how this all kind of started out with the, you know, the Targaryens and the Valyrians. And your food pairing, I never am not chuckling when I think of or hear about barbecue turkey legs. Now, really briefly, and I'm trying to be good with this stuff, things I've already told stories about in past episodes of the podcast. I'm not going to redo the whole story. I'm just going to give a 10-second tease here so people can go back. There must be some way to search podcast. I was involved with someone that did a big food booth at a big food festival for corn. Their idea was, everyone's going to have corn. Let's do something different. And we did barbecue turkey legs and sold like seven of them. But anyway, so that's one thing that always, in a perverted kind of dark humor way, amuses me. But also, whenever I think of a Renaissance fair, I think of turkey legs is really the only good reason to go to one of those, because the way they talk will drive you nuts at one of those places. Because generally I guess they're called performers. We use the term loosely, but anyone employed by a Renaissance fair to run the concessions, they all have to stay in character like they are from medieval times, which is great and fine unless someone's having an issue.
Can you please bring me ye old spreadsheet?
I was with a friend, this is a million years ago, I don't remember what the situation was. I don't know if it was a lost wallet or a purse, or someone had like a real world, like, hey, I need some assistance. And these people would not break character. And my friend was getting so pissed. He's like, can you just cut the... And they're like, I'm sorry, my good sir. The lost and found. I'm not familiar with these terms. We have the vault in the princess's castle that maybe... And they're like, can you just help me? So anyway, they were getting really frustrated. It almost came to blows. And this person would not break character, even in the face of a semi-urgent situation. But anyway, I love the turkey leg. What else would you pair with a House of Dragon type show?
Wine. That's about it.
Unless you can go like take it up a notch. I saw on a show, one of these foodie travel shows, pardon the expression, someone did an entire pork shank that looked like a Fred Flintstone club. You know, picture a turkey leg, but now four times as big on the bone, right up to, I don't know, I guess like almost the shin joint. Now walking around with one of those, swinging one of those at our medieval times, you're going to get some respect.
It's a weapon and a meal. A
weapon and dinner for four. So love it. Love the pairing. Love the show. Love the turkey leg. And yes, Thanksgiving is coming. And I'm generally someone that will grab the turkey leg for the plate, since for whatever reason, most people don't go for the turkey leg.
You know what else is coming, John?
What's that?
Winter.
Winter's coming. Well done. All right, that's a perfect segue. I will white walk myself over to my pairing. And if you ever watched Game of Thrones, the White Walkers, watch out for them. They'll get you. They're not friendly. I don't think I'm spoiling anything. White Walkers, as bad as they sound. All right, my show is on Netflix. It is The Great British Junior Baking Show, which you're like, oh, that's kind of a stupid name. Yeah, it's really called Junior Bake Off. But as we know, Pillsbury kind of jerks. They don't let anyone use the word Bake Off in America. Because, of course, that would totally wreck their whole brand for some reason nobody can explain. In fact, if I'm them, by the way, they're not a sponsor, are they?
No.
Okay. Let me continue my diatribe. Yeah. If I'm them, I want people saying Bake Off, Bake Off, Bake Off, Bake Off. Like, why don't you want people using the word Bake Off as much as they can? You do the Bake Off here. So that aside, it's called Junior Baking Show. And it is the British Bake Off that everyone knows and loves from many seasons past. The most feel-good, most positive, most you're in a bad mood, this will cheer you up show maybe in the history of food television. It's impossible to watch and not just have your brain flooded with serotonin.
You make these emotional connections with these characters on the show, and everybody is so positive, and it is a great show for that. It is the Prozac of television.
Yeah. And unlike an American competition show, if they say time's up and you put one more pee on the plate, they'd be like, you're disqualified. Out of here, lose. Like in Britain, they're like, time's up, Jim. Jim, come, Jimmy, put that powdered sugar down. Put your whatever that is at the end of your bench. So they're very casual. There's no stress. Now imagine that show, already adorable, already feel good. Now we're taking kids that are painfully adorable. Like these kids were bred for adorability. They are just almost too adorable to be true. So they're either that adorable or they're the best actors England has to offer. Now, what's a little surprising about my love for this show is I'm not a big fan of when shows go like the show's good and then we're going to do the celebrity edition, or we're going to do the all-star edition, or we're going to do the kids edition. That's almost a little jump the sharkish where, you know, we kind of had a good run. Like, what can we do to shake this up? Plus, the sound of screaming kids to some of us is like, you know, nails on a chalkboard. So if you're not a big fan of kids, have really no patience for kids, and you'd be like, you know, I'd like to maybe give kids another chance, I would say check out Junior Baking Show. You may actually go, okay, that's what all the fuss is about. These kids are pretty cool. And what's amazing, I cooked at that age. These kids are from like 9 to 15. That's about when I started to like sort of take myself seriously in the kitchen, help my mom make the cookies and the whatevers. So I can totally relate to being that age, and your imagination and your passion far exceed your skill level at that point. And that's where these kids are, which is, makes the show so fun because they're so earnest and it's like they want to do so well, so badly. And when they don't, there's tears, there's self-effacing humor, there's both. It's really a fun show to watch. I highly recommend if you're a fan of kids and or cooking or baking and British television in general.
But not baking children.
Not baking children. That's a fairy tale.
Right. I just want to make sure.
Junior baking show, fairy tale edition with actual human cooking. No, it's a really fun show, easy to watch. And there's two different heats. They got eight kids and then they go down to the final four. And now they got a new set of eight kids that are going to go, and then they're going to mish them together and have a final competition. I assume they figured after like 4 weeks, people are going to get tired of these kids. So we got to get some new kids in. And then by the time these four kids get down to final four, people have forgotten about the running gags with the first four. So I think it works really well, the format. And my pairing is not necessarily something that would appear on the baking show, although during bread week, it certainly could. But I'm going to pair one of the first things I think most kids learn how to make, maybe the first time they get to use the stove, would be for a grilled cheese sandwich.
Oh, yeah.
Mom and or dad show you know, put a little butter on the bread. If mom and dad are foodies, maybe it's a little half mayonnaise, half butter, which, you know, is my unofficial all-time great grilled cheese trick. And for whatever reason, where I grew up, a lot of people call them toasted cheese sandwiches, not grilled cheese, which is interesting. But anyway, I think a nice grilled cheese sandwich made by a nine-year-old, whether it's American cheddar, nice British farmhouse cheddar, I think is the perfect TV watching meal. Easy to make, put it on a plate. You don't even barely need a napkin. Nothing to spill. Although I do dip mine in ketchup, I'm not afraid to admit. Or as us foodies like to call it, tomato chutney. Comfort food with comfort television. All is right with the world. Long live the king.
All right. Well, I haven't seen the show. So it's not that I don't know it's there. I've seen it advertised because I do watch the British Baking Show. And this is not something I have gone into yet, but I have to share a little bit of an anecdote as it relates. So I have a cousin who moved to London after college, and she's a Long Island girl. She sounds like a Long Island girl. I mean, it's not like she has this heavy, thick accent, but she could tell she's from the Northeast of the United States. She moves to London. She meets a man. They get married. They have two children. And their eldest is about seven, I guess she's about 7 or 8 years old now, Francesca. And she looks just like her mother. She looks like a little clone of her mother. And when she opens her mouth, it is the most adorable thing you've ever heard. Because you got this whole family full of like loud New Yorkers, you know, with the heavy Northeastern accents at Christmas time. And she comes in the room and she's like, "Mommy, would it be okay if we had some cheddar cheese today?" And it's just like, oh my God, really? I could see her on the show. That's exactly the image you put in my head of these adorable children, precocious, adorable children with these cute as button English accents. Yeah, I have to go replace some serotonin and get in on that. Absolutely.
And it's funny you mentioned there's nothing more adorable, as you know, than just British slang in general.
Right.
And when you hear a kid say they're chuffed, and I haven't heard of Bob's Your Uncle yet, but it's only a matter of time. But when you hear all these amazing British slang terms that you don't even have to know what they mean for you to enjoy them. Now we got nine-year-olds saying them with flour on their face and chocolate smeared on their cheek. It's almost too adorable to take.
Well, to wrap this up, if Francesca says to me at Christmas this year, because we just learned that they are coming this year to Christmas for the first time in a few years, if she says, "And Bob's your uncle," not only would it be adorable, it would also be true because her grandfather, my uncle, is named Bob.
By the way, does the mom call London Long Island? Long Island? They do a lot of it with the G's, right? Long Island?
Yeah, exactly. She moved across the Atlantic Ocean for a reason.
London Island?
And that's one of them.
Very good. Good pairings. I'm hungry now.
I'm going to go make a grilled cheese.
I'm going to make a grilled cheese with a turkey leg on it. I'll debone it first.
That brings us to another installment of our top five lists. John, tell us about our top five lists, because this is definitely one of yours.
This is definitely one of mine. I like when you introduce these where you say our favorite segment, since 5 to 6 of our segments are definitely my favorite segment. They're all tied for my favorite. But if I had a pick, I would say, except for a couple other ones, this is by far my favorite segment. And this time it is least favorite food cliches. Either they're inaccurate or they just annoy you, or just, as cliches are, completely overused. That's what we're going with today. Would you like me to start?
I would, because John, this list could have been top 50.
There are so many.
Oh my God. Okay, but you should go first.
These are the ones that really, I don't know, batter my cod.
Did you just invent some British slang?
Which I hope is future British food slang cliche. All right, here we go. Number five, a watch pot never boils. I have never enjoyed this cliche, especially when people actually use it in the kitchen, because it's literally not true. It boils in the exact same amount of time, but some poor cook will make the mistake of saying, God, this thing's taking for his rice, taking forever to start. And someone will say, watch pot never boils. And it's like a face with a fist in it. It's harder to make comments.
That's when the frying pan comes flying across the room.
Yeah, that's when that frying pan cliche comes out. So a watch pot never boils is okay used in a completely non-food context, like you're waiting in the office. Okay, I'll let you slide there. But don't use it in the kitchen, because you could sit in a chair and watch that pot boil and, oh, it will boil. And if it doesn't, then we got a headline. Then we'll do a whole podcast on the time we watched the pot and it actually didn't boil and Chef John was wrong. And we also do a whole correction segment. So yes, a watch pot never boils. Never been a fan of that cliche, mostly just because it makes no sense. I understand the metaphor, but no, never use that in the kitchen. You young cooks coming up through the ranks, when someone complains about having to wait for something, a stock to simmer, don't break out that one. They've heard it. They're not amused.
And if you do, duck.
Frying pan incoming. All right. For number four, hand carved. The phrase hand carved, or let me add on, hand cut, hand selected, hand shaped. I mean, it is simply a very cliched sales point, I guess, that people put on menus. People put in their advertisements, people put on their Yelp descriptions. I don't know. That you hand formed your burger does not impress me. I could care less if you took the burger meat and put it in a mold and smushed it with a machine or a tool and came out with a perfect size burger, or Jim and Prep Station is hand forming those. I don't care. That doesn't make it any better. Hand carved turkey sandwich. Don't care whether you put it on a slicer or you hand carved it. Now, what it's supposed to convey is freshly made. Apparently, if someone hears hand carved roast beef or hand carved turkey breast, they can picture a whole piece of meat being like someone's arm going back and forth, cutting a piece off, where, I don't know, I guess on an electric meat slicer or just a manual meat slicer, like in a deli, they think, oh, that's probably turkey loaf. Why would anyone machine slice a fresh breast? You got to hand carve those. Everybody knows that. Hand cut fries. Wow. Really? They're hand cut? Those sound great. Like if I put them in the French fry machine that cuts them, are they different? No, they're not. They're actually probably better. In fact, can we just say this? No offense to humans, but I'll take a machine shaped piece of meat or food product pretty much any time over a hungover prep cook. I've been that hungover prep cook hand breading your crab cakes. And man, I would have much preferred it if we had a machine that did our crab cakes. So whenever I see the phrase hand carved, hand cut, hand selected, technically, if you think about it, everything's hand selected.
Well, unless you don't have hands.
Yeah, well, that's true. And if you don't, we're here for you. But is anyone mentally, like through telepathy, selecting things and they're showing up on the order? So not a big fan of the cliche hand dash anything. I understand what they're trying to convey. Fresh, homemade. We're not, what's the word, mechanized. We're not
processed.
We are highly unprocessed. They're just trying to put the humanity back. And they're carving, cutting, selecting, and shaping. But they don't fool me, except at Ye Olde Cookshop, which is another reference to an old podcast story. Do yourself a favor. Again, if this is your first Chef John podcast, go back and find the episode where I make fun of a restaurant in San Francisco that was open for about 4 days until the people were found embezzling everybody, like the city, the employees, the health department. Anyway, it was called Ye Olde Cookshop.
No, it was called Cookshop, and I called it Ye Olde.
Oh, that's
Cookshop.
Right. It's actually called the Cookshop, but they spelled it in the old world Z with the extra P's and O's and E's. Anyway, they, I'm sure, hand-carved, hand-selected, and hand-shaped all their food.
Absolutely.
Because when you're back in the ye olde days, that's how you do it. All right. That brings us to number three, cooked to perfection. This is the all-time worst menu cliche. In fact, I still do this to this day. Michelle can attest to this. No one thinks it's funny anymore. I barely am amused by it, but I still do it. If I ever see cooked to perfection on a menu, I will call the server over and I'll point to the menu and I'll be like, excuse me, this chicken sandwich here says the chicken breast is cooked to perfection. Is that true? Not that the server is going to have any pull like getting this taken off the menu, but I just want to convey how ridiculous it is. I'll be the judge of that. You bring me the chicken breast. And then later when I'm done, you can ask me, was that cooked to perfection? And if it was, I'm happy to tell you. But you don't get to print it on the menu first.
It's a bit presumptuous.
Yes. Would you like to go on a date? It's going to be one of the best dates you've ever had. Well, let's see how it works out first.
Yeah, let's set the bar a little lower.
Yeah. So anyway, cooked to perfection, I think, is a hilarious and just horrible menu cliche. Also, like, what does that even mean? Like, you know, depends. Cooked to perfection, I like my steaks well done. This perfectly juicy medium rare steak is not cooked to perfection. I think your menu is quite misleading, sir. So anyway, if you're doing menus in a restaurant, do us all a favor. The words cooked to perfection should not appear anywhere on there. In fact, we'll just assume it's cooked in some form or fashion, and then we will experience it and see what happens. So please, no cooked to perfection. Which brings us to number two. Unctuous. And I got good news for everybody. Apparently, you don't have to know what it means to use it.
Oh, okay, great.
Like 95% of the people are using it. Now, I'll just give you my definition, which I think is pretty close. Maybe someone can Google it while I'm talking. Unctuous conveys a certain fattiness, richness in a food, like someone that's only had kind of dry, lean pulled pork loin on a pulled pork sandwich, and then someone transports them to North Carolina for a whole hog barbecue, which is all the fat and sinew and connective tissue just mushed and mashed into this perfect amalgamation, put on your bun, and you bite into that, and there's just grease, pork fat dripping out of the sides of your mouth. That's an unctuous bite of food. So that's what it's supposed to mean. But somehow it became a description for just something that's kind of rich and kind of, I don't know, over the top satisfying or just fatty in general. And what's so funny about this word is it was made popular by a person who I think more than anyone hated people using it incorrectly or overusing it or making it become what it is today, a cliche, and that's Anthony Bourdain. I don't think your average food curious person on the street was ever using the word unctuous until Bourdain started traveling around. And, you know, you do those shows, you run out of ways to describe things.
You know that Anthony Bourdain's mother was a copy editor at the New York Times. So there was a lot of vocabulary going on in that house.
So he used it, I'm assuming, perfectly correctly in the right context, in the right setting, in the right way. And then maybe a couple more times. And then food writers who worshiped at the throne of Mr. Bourdain started dropping a few unctuous into their writing and their descriptions. And then before you know it, everybody and their uncle on Yelp is like, oh my God, the oatmeal at that diner, it's so unctuous. And it's like, no, that's wrong. You can't call oatmeal unctuous just because they put an extra big piece of butter in it. So please, people, Google the actual specific definition, which, oh, hold on. I got the official definition coming in from the control room. If you describe food as unctuous, you mean it is creamy or oily. Okay, I'll go with that. I always think it's more of like a greasy than oily.
It just depends on the usage, but there's no real good positive definition there.
And by the way, if you're a person and we're not talking about food and someone calls you unctuous.
Oh, it just means you're greasy.
Exactly. In a non-food way. Yeah. So it has non-food definitions.
And that correlation, I just don't want that like connected to my food.
Yeah. So anyway, to wrap this up, unctuous, perfectly fine when it started out, a new fun word food writers could use to describe a certain thing. And then the great unwashed masses of the internet and social media started going, oh, wait, what's that word? I'm going to use that word at a cocktail party. And it just spun out of control. And as I said, now people are calling oatmeal unctuous and it is not correct. And Anthony Bourdain, may he rest in peace. It's his fault. He, I think, started the unctuous craze. And I'm sure at this point would be very much unhappy with its explosion of popularity.
Yeah, he would definitely not like that.
No. So anyway, that's it. Unctuous, use it, but use it wisely and with reservations. That brings us to number one, everything's better with bacon. No, it's not. And the reason I chose this as my number one cliche Because you know something is truly a cliche, just not when it's overused, but when you start to say something in a very specific situation, and any average person on the street will actually finish the cliche for you. For example, we're cooking a pasta, put me in any kitchen in the world. They're just like, here, grab a few ingredients, throw a pasta together. And then I go, maybe we'll do a little crumbled bacon on the top. And you're like, you know what? Let's go for it. You throw it on there. Someone next to you, 95% of the time will say, hey, everything's better with bacon. It's just like an automatic response. So to me, those are the real cliches that you can see, like the person's lips forming the cliche when you get to a certain part of the conversation. And I like bacon. It's very good in many, many things, but it does not make everything better. And I will give you one very quick example since we're coming up to Thanksgiving. As you know, I'm a traditionalist when it comes to the Thanksgiving side dishes.
Oh, I have a feeling I know where this is going.
We've done whole segments on this. One year, something got into me and I'm like, you know what would be good in the stuffing? Some bacon. I'm going to saute the mirepoix in the bacon. Everything's better with bacon. How's that not going to be good? Everything's better with bacon, right? I heard that three times already today. So I tried it. Bacon did it. It was the worst stuffing I'd ever done for Thanksgiving. All you can taste, especially in something like that, was bacon fat, which if you're doing a bacon exploration, great. But that's not what you want overwhelming your turkey and your green bean casserole and your mashed potato. It was bacon way too over the top flavor profile wise, which was honorable mention on my list, flavor profile. But anyway, please do me a favor. Stop saying everything's better with bacon. You could say that would be good with bacon. I'm okay with that. But just everything's better with bacon is a ridiculous statement. I don't know how that became a thing. In fact, this is like early social media people sharing food picture. Remember the bacon craze, like bacon wrapped on everything, bacon foams, bacon powder. Oh my God, remember bacon powder? I was like, where do you get bacon powder? Are people sending away for this? No bacon powder at the store. It was like three molecular gastronomists had like a dehydrator and they were doing bacon powder and people thought it was a thing. So I think that everything's better with bacon probably came into the forefront during those ridiculous 2 or 3 years when bacon appeared in every single ingredient list. But I'm over it. Many things are better with bacon. Everything? No. And that's conclude my list.
Well, John, I'm going to jump in and just make some quick comments on your list. I agree with a lot of what you said here. A watch pot never boils. You made the qualification that you should not use this in the kitchen and other places it's okay. I'm here to tell you, no, it's not.
Never anywhere.
No, never anywhere. Just leave it alone. The watch pot never boiling cliche needs to be retired. It's wholly untrue, really annoying, and needs to disappear.
So when you're at the barber waiting for a haircut and the barber is taking forever with the person in front of you, and you keep staring them down, like staring dagger, and the person next to you, your buddy who's getting his haircut after you, says, hey, watch pot never boils. That's not appropriate.
No, I have nothing more on that.
And above and beyond that, why are you in a barbershop?
That's the other problem. Guys looking over at me going, that guy doesn't need to be here.
I can take my time.
And then, of course, your commentary on hand-carved, hand-cut, hand-selected, hand-shaped. Oh, my God, I can't agree with this more. The other word that you kind of left out here, which encompasses all of these things and is equally, if not more annoying, is handcrafted.
Wait, you want a machine-made cocktail? I almost said the bartenders use it. No, the mixologists use it.
Right. So if someone is preparing your food, there's a very, very good chance they're doing it with their hands. Therefore, everything is handcrafted. So let's leave that one on the side of the road and drive away. Okay. So we're going to leave handcrafted and all related ancillary hand instrumental situations there. We're going to leave those alone when it comes to food.
Yes.
Cooked to perfection. You touched on the idea that perfection is subjective. And I am a word person. I get hung up on words like this.
What's another word for that?
A word person?
Yeah.
That would be a...
Maybe you're not quite the word person.
Oh, very good.
As you were.
I could throw cruciverbalist at you.
Ooh, no, that works.
Okay, good.
I'm so glad I interrupted. I'm actually going to look that up after the show.
Okay, onward. Unctuous. I think we kind of touched on this in our conversation back and forth. It's not necessarily a very positive word. So with all due respect to Mr. Bourdain or the ghost of Bourdain or whoever is using these words at this point, we need to also probably leave that one alone. And your number one everything's better with bacon. It's kind of an annoying cliche, but isn't it?
See, you're part of the problem. Do you want me to give you one quick example?
No, I don't want any more examples. All I know is that when people are using bacon and ice cream and, I mean, everything.
Is this if you can't beat them, join them type?
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm just at.
Give in to the baconness?
Yeah, I'm my father's son too. My father's idea of breakfast is 2 pounds of bacon and a whiff of eggs.
Bacon and eggs and toast. Hold the eggs and the toast.
Exactly right. So obviously, I'm in great agreement with most of your list. And I can understand where you're coming from with the bacon situation, but I am a big fan of bacon. So I may be a little more lenient on that one. But that will bring us to my list, John. At number 5, food is sinful, bad, or naughty. I hate this cliche about food, John. I can't stand it. And not just from a perspective of food is not good or bad, right? Food is what you make of it. Everything in moderation is usually okay. But when we start to assign the idea that certain foods are good and certain foods are bad, we are entering into dangerous territory. I really want to leave this one again at the side of the road. There's going to be a whole bunch of cliches waiting at the side of the road for a ride. Somebody might want to pick them up, but the Chef John bus is going to go right by them. The next one at number 4, food is a party in your mouth. Oh God, John, I cringe every time I hear this. And it's also kind of has a little bit of another connotation that I don't think is all that flattering. I don't like it. I think a party in your mouth is odd and weird. I can't imagine what a party in my mouth would be, like little people, like have a little table and they're drinking, and that could be really dangerous. So party in your mouth, got to leave that one. Hitchhiking on Route 80. At number 3, tastes like heaven. Let's break this one down. Let's do a little parsing here like we did in poetry class. Tastes, okay, very good. This is what we do with food. We taste the food. Like, I mean, now we're into simile, right? Heaven. Do we know what heaven looks like, smells like? We don't have any concept of heaven. Heaven is taken on faith, right? For a good portion of our people. So we have no idea what heaven is, what it looks like, smells like, and especially we have no idea what heaven tastes like. So we're going to maybe abandon that food cliche. Maybe someone will resurrect it or bring it to St. Peter, and maybe he has a different opinion of it. But I'm not in the game of overusing the cliche of taste like heaven. Not a fan. At number 2, this sort of might actually tie into number 3, because I really can't stand the phrase to die for. Now, if you're going to die for it because it tastes like heaven, maybe have a little insight into what's going to happen next, because I have no idea what's going to happen next. Heaven might be a possibility, but I'm not quite sure what that tastes like, and I certainly don't want to die for it. So there is nothing on a plate that I'm willing to die for, unless, of course, there is no food. Then, of course, that becomes a necessity to die for it. If there is one can of beans, John, left on this earth, and it's between you and me, I might have to die for it.
Sounds like a great screenplay we could start working on.
Right.
The Last Can of Beans.
The Last Can of Beans, starring John and Andrew. And finally, at number 1, the one that makes my skin crawl the most is when people refer to food as it's just like crack. I'm not sure where to begin with this one. I don't like the connotation. I don't like the implication. I don't like the idea that there's this correlation between horrible drug addiction and food. I guess this goes back to my idea that foods are not sinful, naughty, or bad. But the idea that we want to use this particular word with all the misery and suffering that surrounds it, not a fan. Don't like it. Think we need to leave that one alone. And I feel like it's irresponsible in a way. Maybe I'm being a little oversensitive, but as food cliches go, this one really gets under my skin. So I'm going to leave that one right where it is. And I'm not sure where you stand on this, John, but I have an honorable mention.
Yes.
Food is a guilty pleasure. This also goes back to number 5. I have a very circular list here, John. I do not like the idea that we are assigning the idea that we should feel guilty about enjoying ourselves. Pleasure is something we are built for as people, right?
Yeah. Great top 5 list, sponsored by Dante. That was all virtue, the deadly sin. I mean, we had it all there. Heaven, hell.
I went dark and medieval. It's all that dragon talk. It's got me in a weird frame of mind.
And once again, I've used a reference backed up by no reading or actual education. So apparently I got away with it and the Dante reference worked.
Yeah, it was fine.
Okay, well, let me get into this because I agree with most of them. I have a couple bones to pick with you.
That's a food cliche, John. That one got to get on my list.
I was hoping you'd say, oh, I see what you did there. Anyway, the food is sinful, bad, naughty. Yeah. What does that even mean? It's high calorie. Like, I guess that's what people mean sinful. Now, if you're trying to entice someone in eating it, I guess people tend to skew towards things that are like, ooh, we're not supposed to have that. Huh, I didn't want it before. Now I really want to try it.
That's marketing though, John.
Advertising, marketing, madmen of the world. I think they're to blame for that. But I agree. Overdone, overwrought, just used, unnecessary. Could not agree more with a party in your mouth. Oh, that soup. Oh, it was a party in my mouth. No, don't say that, please. It's the first half of a really disgusting joke reference, which I will not go any further into. So never should a party in your mouth be used until the day comes when they can finally prove the theory that inside our bodies, on a micromolecular subatomic level, these things we assume are just completely irrelevant living creatures like bacteria, fungus, things that are virtually invisible in the body, don't have some kind of intelligence.
Oh, okay. I get it.
And aren't able to communicate. Now, when and if they prove that all those disgusting bacteria things that live on our tongue are communicating, and when you eat something really good, they literally throw a party, then we'll have to reevaluate this.
And why do you call them disgusting, John? Why are you so judgmental?
I guess I'm projecting.
We got to pull this back from the abyss, John. I took us down a really dark road and we got to pull it back.
Okay. Number, let's see, three, tastes like heaven. This one I'm not crazy about because I think there's a much better way to say that.
Okay.
I, on occasion, will describe something as otherworldly because I don't even know how to describe it. It just took me to another place. It was transcended. It was like, how do I even describe how much pleasure I'm taking in this food, this bite? And I'll say otherworldly, and like, there's not the language of our species and planet doesn't do it justice. So maybe that's what people mean when they say tastes like heaven, like another plane of existence where you will finally understand the level of deliciousness.
So it's more Eastern philosophy than Western in your estimation.
Yes. Speaking of which, the only appropriate taste like heaven that I know of is when you're describing Asian fish sauce and you tell someone, smells like hell, tastes like heaven. I've always tried to get people to use it. I use it in lots of recipes. People are afraid of it. If you don't use it a lot, it's hard to start using. If you use it, you're like, how the hell is everyone not using this? It's like the best thing ever.
Yep.
And yeah, if you open the bottle and take a whiff, you're like, I'm not using this. Why would I use this? But it tastes, pardon the expression, heavenly. So if we've only taught you one thing today, don't be afraid of fish sauce. It doesn't taste as bad as it smells, as I guess where I'm going with this. Number two, to die for. That's a little extreme. I've had some delicious things in my life, but never one where I was like, all right, it's it. I'm done. Hit me over the head with that shovel. I understand what people are trying to convey with that. It is so good. They would do anything, literally anything for it, but it needs to be retired. Again, like the unctuous oatmeal, it's just used too much. Like, oh my God, that smoothie was to die for. They used wheatgrass instead of alfalfa sprouts. Like, okay, really to die for. And then, yeah, like crack, agree, a cliche, overused, probably inappropriate, although I'm on the fence with this one. And I'll tell you a very personal anecdote. I did a dip, which is an amazing dip called Cowboy Crack.
Oh boy.
And it really is the perfect name because it's a vegetable dip that's conveyed this highly addictiveness. And by using the name for a simple vegetable dip and calling it Cowboy Crack, you've given the audience some info to go with. Like, this is going to be very addictive. So in that context, is it insensitive? Yes. But as the creator, when it was me that had to have the word crack changed, and I had to call it like, ooh, cowboy dip or something not quite as colorful, I was actually kind of bummed and kind of annoyed and PO'd for a little bit. Cause I was like, in this context, I think it's okay. But yes, crack, not appropriate. I can understand how it made your list and made number one, because it's one thing using a cliched term that's just overused, but then there's using one that's overused and annoying and just stupid that makes people like sad. and depressed. So we don't want to do that. Let's all not use crack anymore. That was a very good top five list. And I think if we could maybe have the audience take this top five list a little more serious than usual, and please just stop using all these phrases.
So at the end of each show, we like to take some time to talk about our careers in food visuals. So let's spend some time taking a peek behind the curtain. John, I think I want to go first this week because I have a pretty funny story about when I was still out in the field as a field food photographer doing the restaurant beat in New York City. We're going back to we're talking like 2005, 2006, where I was out doing restaurants. And quite often when you go into a restaurant, you'll get people who are a little sensitive about being photographed, particularly when they're eating. And I've always tried to be sensitive to that and be careful. And if I could see people were uncomfortable or somebody actually said, you know, they waved their hand at me and they didn't want to be part of the photo, I would say, sure. And I would just readjust and shoot in a different direction. So this was something that happened quite often. So it was not something I wasn't used to. And I went to the Spotted Pig, which is a very famous restaurant in New York City in the West Village, and had sort of a notorious chapter in the Me Too movement with some of the things that happened at this restaurant. So my story is a bit ironic. I was in the restaurant and I was photographing, and I'm in a particular angle and I'm photographing the interior of the dining room, and there's some diners in the background and people moving through. And a guy comes over to me and he's like, hey, listen, I don't want to be in the picture. I said, yeah, sure. No problem. He wasn't in my picture, but I think because of the position I was in, he thought he was in the picture, but I wasn't using a wide lens. I was actually using a long lens. So I was shooting right past his table. So I keep peeking out of the corner of my eye and I see him and he's still agitated and he's trying to hide his face. I'm thinking, what is this guy like in witness protection? Like, what's the situation here? Then he comes up to me and he gets aggressive. And he's like, yo, man, I told you I don't want to be in your picture. And I said, you're not in my picture. He's like, well, you're still standing there. I'm like, okay, well, you're not in my picture. Well, I need you to move. I'm like, yeah, but I'm not going to move. So he gets upset and he goes to the table and he gets his check and he leaves. And the woman is still sitting there. And I'm thinking, what just went on here?
Classy.
And I realized what happened was he was there with somebody who wasn't his wife. He thought that I was a PI or I was somebody like trying to get a picture of him doing something he wasn't supposed to be doing, or he didn't want to see this picture in a newspaper where he was someplace he wasn't supposed to be. So it was a pretty odd encounter. And it was just the nature of the way it went down made it a little obvious what was happening. But I had quite a few strange encounters while shooting inside restaurants in my life. And this one ranks at the top of the list because it almost ended in a physical confrontation because this person was either in a place or with somebody who he wasn't supposed to be with. Very strange when you're out there in the field dealing with the public, but gave me plenty of stories for a podcast, John.
Yeah. And, you know, of course, if you are out to dinner with someone that's not your wife and you're terrified of being discovered and busted, what you definitely want to do is call attention to yourself by getting up in a photographer's face in a very guilty type of way and making a big fuss. And then when you see they're still going to keep shooting, just walk out and leave clearly someone that doesn't mean that much to you at the table. There's no way that's going to give you away.
Nope.
And by the way, people, this is what Uber Eats is for. This is what hotel room service is for. Do we have to explain everything? Anyway, I'm not going to give any more advice to the infidels.
Yeah, the infidels. A little different meaning, but yeah, we'll take it.
I'm a person that has all the word people, person. I forget what the word for that is. What was that again? A contortionist? A convulsionist? Khrushchev. Khrushchevist.
Yeah, that one.
By the way, you better Google that. I'm putting that in my last segment today. That was an interesting one. I don't think I've accidentally ever outed anyone during one of my food videos. Although way back in the day, I used to shoot once in a while when I needed to phone in a video. I would go to a restaurant and just film an open kitchen making something and I would eat it. And I don't think I caught any infidels during that. But anyway, good story. My little peek behind the curtain is in the health conscious vein here for a chef slash person that has food on the stove all the time. I try to eat pretty well over the years. I've definitely, as we've talked about in the past, given up the fast food, cut down the beers, no more than 3 IPAs a day, unless it's a special occasion. Michelle and I try to eat not low fat, but good fat, lots of good fats, high fiber, lots of vegetables, lots of fruit, you know, all the stuff you're supposed to do. The problem is when you have a job like this, you can't film unctuous oatmeal every episode. And to quote my good friend and fictitious philosopher, Homer Simpson, you don't make friends with salad. Or was that Bart Simpson? One of the two Simpsons said, you don't make friends with salad. There's actually a song. But anyway, the point is, I can't film only healthy, delicious superfoods that are just good for the heart and blood and liver and so forth. Every once in a while, like almost every recipe, is something opposite of that. So that's my little peek behind the curtain challenge edition. How the heck are we supposed to eat healthy and film cronuts and jalapeno poppers and deep fried bacon wrap jalapeno popper casserole enchiladas, waffles, with an eye to our healthy diet? So I find this to be a huge challenge. I know you probably have the same problem when you shoot a thing that's like the Twinkie episode. And you're like, oh no, these things are sitting around. What am I supposed to not eat them? So that's always a challenge. And then the obvious answer that people in the audience be like, just give it to your neighbors, which we do on occasion. The problem is I like my neighbors. And as you know, you'll film something. For me, it's always at the end of the day. I try to time it with that perfect golden light to get the final shots. And if you don't quite get down to the last shot being perfect, you wrap up what you made, especially something that's going to keep, and you photograph it the next day. And if that doesn't work, maybe even a third day, you've gotten another piece of that cake and you maybe tried a different garnish. So this is a normal routine thing that happens. So by the third or fourth day, something's been around. I mean, are we giving it to our neighbors all kind of dried out and you've touched it and it's been unwrapped and rewrapped and unwrapped? So I'm always extremely careful not poisoning my neighbors. If there is like a fresh batch of cookies, I know I nailed the shots. Absolutely, we'll go try to give them away and not eat them all. But in general, especially the savory food, when you're trying to stay on a certain calorie restrictive number and you don't want to go over whatever it is, 2,500 for the day, since that tends to be what works out for me. Man, that's hard to do when you just made a big old pot of fat soup or whatever.
Cassoulet.
Oh, cassoulet. Perfect for the week. We're supposed to be just eating veggies. So that I find one of the biggest challenges with this job. I know people are out there playing their tiny violins like, oh.
Yeah, I know.
But health-wise, it can be a concern because if I didn't have bad willpower, I would have no willpower at all. So I end up eating it.
John, I think that the word we've been looking for the entire show, and I think your last verbal stumble leads me right there, is logophile, John. The person who loves words is a logophile.
Now, is that the same thing as a person with a giant vocabulary?
Wordsmith?
See, that's what I was looking for, because you were started going, you are a man of letters and like words and know all several of words.
I know a few of them.
I always think it's funny that people can never come up with a word for someone that has a huge, vast vocabulary of words. It's not a vocabularyist. Anyway.
Oh, wait, there's a word, John.
What is it?
It's going to take me a second to actually pronounce it. Sesquipedalian. That is somebody with a big vocabulary.
Easy for you to say. But anyway, that is our peek behind the curtain. If you don't mind us, we will be pulling the curtain back right now. And that's it. You can't see us.
So, John, it's always sad when we're at the end of the show, especially one that took us through Dante's seventh circle of hell. And what did we learn today?
Well, a couple of things we learned, I already went over. If you're cheating on your wife, don't go to a restaurant. Andrew might be there. Take your picture. And all of a sudden, you're in the New York Times food section and your wife's like, hey, wait a minute. That's not me. We learned, much to my chagrin, which is a pretty good word, you have to admit.
That's a good one. You pulled that one out.
There's not a really good, accessible word for a person that really knows a lot of words. I'm not happy with logophile. I'm not going with that.
Well, it's easier to pronounce than the actual word.
But really, we're burying the lead here. What we did learn is foodie is okay to use, contrary to popular belief, unless you are talking with an overpaid, way overeducated food writer in certain neighborhoods in Manhattan. It's probably okay to use the word foodie and hold your head up high. And I think it really is people project that word through their lens of the foodies they know. If the foodies they know are pretentious and self-righteous, then foodie is probably annoying to them. If foodie is used by just people that are saying they like food and love food or describing people as such, totally okay to use. So to me, that was the biggest thing we learned today. I was surprised by our poll results. I thought it was going to be 60-40 the other way. So that was good to know. And by the way, I think I have a solution.
What's that?
If a foodie is someone that really is into food and all things food, let's call a person that has a lot of words a wordie. And that's it. We're done. We thank you for listening. Always appreciate it. Leave us a comment. Leave us a rating. And we only have one last thing to do. And that's say goodnight, Andrew.
Goodnight, Andrew.